Jones beats Moore, GOP blames Bannon, and more women say Me Too to Trump. It's a sassy horse you rode in on edition of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Trump and the Republicans take a Senate seat they should have won and fritter it away. Is there a lesson for 2018?
When I would talk to Republicans during the race and say, well, what's your best case scenario for 2018 for the Senate? They said, oh, just limiting our losses. In other words, staying the same was beyond their wildest dreams. Now I think they feel more confident.
Plus, a new biography of William McKinley talks about power and political dominance. Spoiler alert, he was also assassinated.
He didn't come crashing into office with great plans or visions. But he knew how to manage events, and he knew where he wanted to take America. And where he wanted to take America was where he did take America.
And former Houston Mayor Anise Parker has a new job. She'll tell us about her fight to elect more gay and lesbian candidates to public office.
Finding, training, recruiting, putting good candidates in the field, supporting those candidates, building coalitions, and trying to do it in a way that engages the younger voters out there who are going to be, you know, running this world that we're going to leave them, they need to start taking a stake in it.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 209 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. When was the last time the entire nation was watching a Senate race in Alabama, of all places, where the results are usually preordained? The victory Tuesday of Doug Jones over Roy Moore was one of the great upsets in political history. We'll get to that race in a moment. For all those who wondered why Al Franken and John Conyers had to pay the price for sexual harassment with their jobs, while President Trump remained immune to similar allegations, things may be changing. This week, several women who last year during the campaign accused then-candidate Trump of inappropriate behavior have resurfaced and are doubling down on Trump over an apparent double standard. Samantha Hulvey, once a Miss USA contestant, talked about her dreams and how they were ruined by her interactions with Donald Trump.
These dreams never included a man lining us all up to look us over like we were pieces of meat. These dreams never included a man coming into the backstage hair and makeup area while I sat naked under a robe as he walked around looking at us like we were his property before he moved into the dressing room. And these dreams certainly never included this same man becoming president of the United States. I have a new dream now, that this man will be held accountable for his actions and that future generations of women can fulfill their dreams without worry of anyone treating them like they are less than because they're a woman.
Jessica Leeds remembered her encounter with Trump on an airplane decades ago.
And it became apparent that in some areas, the accusations of sexual aggression were being taken seriously, and people were being held accountable, except for our president, and he was not being held accountable. In fact, his staff made a big point of calling us all liars.
Not long after, many Democratic lawmakers called for Trump's resignation. Among them, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who spoke Monday on CNN.
Well, President Trump should resign. These allegations are credible. They are numerous. I've heard these women's testimony, and many of them are heartbreaking. And President Trump should resign his position. Whether he will ever hold himself accountable is something, you know, you really can't hold your breath for. And so Congress should have hearings. They should do their investigation. They should have appropriate investigations of his behavior and hold him accountable.
A day later, to no one's surprise, Trump tweeted this. Lightweight Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a total flunky for Charles E. Schumer and someone who had come to my office begging for campaign contributions not so long ago and would do anything for them, is now in the ring fighting against Trump. The part where the president said and would do anything for them ignited a firestorm. Senator Elizabeth Warren said Trump was trying to slut-shame Gillibrand. For her part, Gillibrand responded this way, talking to Savannah Guthrie Wednesday on NBC's The Today Show.
Let me be blunt about it. Did you interpret that tweet as a sexual reference, that you would trade sexual favors for campaign cash? Is that what the president was saying about you?
Well, certainly that's how I and many people read it, and it was certainly just a sexist smear intended to silence me. And I'm not going to be silenced on this issue. I've heard the testimony of many women, numerous accusers. I believe them.
A tweet comprised of sexual innuendo? Nonsense, said White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
I think only if your mind is in the gutter would you have read it that way.
All of which led the USA Today editorial board to write this. As is the case with all of Trump's digital provocations, the president's words were deliberate. He pours the gasoline of sexist language and lights the match gleefully, knowing how it will burst into flame in a country reeling from the Me Too moment. A president who would all but call Senator Kirsten Gillibrand a whore is not fit to clean the toilets in the Barack Obama Presidential Library or to shine the shoes of George W. Bush, unquote. That is strong stuff, and not easy to segue out of. Still, the other big political news on Wednesday was that Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton named his lieutenant governor, Tina Smith, a fellow Democrat, to succeed Al Franken once Franken finally quits the Senate. And that leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last woman appointed to fill a vacancy in the Senate? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
We gotta get you.
It was a result that few thought was possible. On Tuesday, in Ruby Red, Alabama, Doug Jones, a liberal pro-choice Democrat running in a state that hasn't elected a Democrat to the Senate in 25 years, was the winner.
Oh, my! Folks, I gotta tell you, I think that I have been waiting all my life and now I just don't know what the hell to say.
Jones defeated Roy Moore, the already controversial Republican who was accused by a growing number of women who said he had inappropriate sexual conduct with them, including one woman who said the incidents occurred when she was just 14 years old, and another who was 16 at the time, when Moore, who is now 70, was in his 30s. That led to a deep split in the Republican Party, with President Trump, after some hesitation, and Steve Bannon showing no hesitation, deciding to go all out and endorse him, while others, such as Alabama Senator Richard Shelby and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, saying no way. As of this recording, the difference between Jones and Moore was fewer than 21,000 votes. Moore has refused to concede and said it's in God's hands. We couldn't get God on this week's program, but we do have Mara Liasson, NPR's national political correspondent. Mara, welcome to back to the Political Junkie, and I'm sorry that you were our second choice.
Oh, but that's what you always say.
Yeah, but God only knows. Exactly right.
I saw a tweet this week said, yes, but God was a black woman.
Right. Perfect. Well, anyway, so obviously we're talking on Wednesday afternoon, but the shock of Tuesday's results are still here. Did you see it coming at all?
No. Most political analysts, I would say, across the board, Democrat and Republican, thought that even though the race was close, that the most recent polls had shown more stabilizing, maybe even pulling ahead. I think the latest average had him a couple points ahead. And because there hadn't been any new accusations against him, he seemed to have the advantage. After all, this is Alabama, where it's almost mathematically impossible for a Democrat to win. because all sorts of things had to fall into place, and lo and behold, all of them fell into place. Black vote turned out in huge numbers, just enough Republican moderates, Chamber of Commerce types, Republican college-educated women crossed over, and Doug Jones pulled off something that most people didn't think he could.
And whether or not these Republicans crossed over or, as Richard Shelby said, he voted for a third-party candidate, or many of them may have stayed home.
I think they did both. I think that for Jones to win, they had to cross over, enough of them had to cross over and vote for him more than just staying home. In other words, that wouldn't have been enough for him. He needed one-third of the white vote, and he got just about 30% of the white vote. So he had to have some crossover votes, in addition to the fact that the Republican vote was depressed. People stayed home. The Democrats were much more enthusiastic, and they did something that Democrats have had a terrible time accomplishing in these midterm elections for years and years, which is getting their coalition out in a non-presidential year. It's almost like they've been cursed. But as we saw in Virginia and then Tuesday night in Alabama, they did it. They got out huge numbers of minorities, young people, college-educated women, and this is what happens when the Democratic coalition turns out.
What do you make of the role Steve Bannon plays? I don't see any signs that he's backing away with his ongoing war with the establishment and Mitch McConnell and that he's going to go away anytime soon.
No. Steve Bannon, however, lost, and he looks less threatening today than he did before Tuesday. And I think the civil war inside the Republican Party continues. But Steve Bannon lost, and he lost in a place where at least one former Mitch McConnell aide said you could have taken any name out of the phone book in Alabama except Roy Moore's, put an R next to it, and won by double digits. In other words, this was a race that is almost incomprehensible that a Democrat won. So I think Bannon's stock is a little bit low today. And I think that he will go forward, of course, and he can blame this on Mitch McConnell. But he was trying to start a real insurrection inside the Republican Party. He said he was going to back a challenger to every single Republican Senate incumbent, and he was going to make the litmus test whether or not they would vote for Mitch McConnell as leader. And I think Mitch McConnell now can say, look, this is like 2010. When the Tea Party nominates candidates that aren't ready for prime time, we lose general elections. And Steve Bannon is just the latest iteration of this. And look what happened in Alabama. That's going to make a much stronger argument for people who say Republicans should support the establishment candidate.
And what about the role of, I mean, we're forgetting the big guy, President Trump, who, he supported Luther Strange, then he wasn't for Roy Moore, then he was, and then as it turned out, he was enthusiastically for Roy Moore.
That's right. I think that what we've learned is that Donald Trump can only get his voters to vote for him. He couldn't get them to vote for Ed Gillespie in Virginia. He couldn't get them to vote for Luther Strange in the Republican primary in Alabama, and he couldn't get them to vote for Roy Moore in the general election in Alabama. So he doesn't seem to have a lot of juice. And don't forget, Roy Moore was Trump before Trump. He was the Trumpist candidate before Donald Trump even showed up on the scene. And Donald Trump still couldn't heave him over the finish line. So this was a big repudiation for him. As you said, he was ambivalent about Moore in the beginning. As soon as Luther Strange lost, he supported Moore, of course. He was the Republican candidate. Then when the charges came out, he said, well, if they're true, he should step aside. That morphed into, well, the voters should decide. And then he gave that up and went all in for Moore, and he had a rally, and he recorded robocalls, and it still didn't work.
Is it possible that they voted against him, against Moore, because they found out he had a Jewish lawyer?
That was one of the best pieces of tape.
Is that amazing?
In the entire campaign.
Fake news would tell you that we don't care for Jews. I tell you all this because I've seen it all, so I just want to set the record straight while they're here. One of our attorneys is a Jew. We have very close friends that are Jewish and rabbis, and we also fellowship with them.
I want you to also assess Richard Shelby's role. I think
that was huge.
I do too.
I really do. I actually think Trump might have had a negligible effect either way. I don't know if he energizes Democrats, but I don't know if he had a big effect either way. Richard Shelby, on the other hand, sitting Republican senator, went on television. He is not somebody who goes on the Sunday shows normally. And he said that he wasn't going to vote for Roy Moore. He was going to write in a candidate. And I think that was a very, very important message.
You know, when you just said that, you don't know what role Trump played either way. I always made the argument that no matter what the result was in Alabama, it was almost lose-lose for the Republican Party. But I, now that I'm thinking of it, I wonder if the Republicans dodged a bullet with Roy Moore losing.
Yes, I think there's definitely a silver lining. The bad news for Republicans is Roy Moore lost. The good news for Republicans is Roy Moore lost. Because if he had been in there, he would have... Every single day, Republicans would have had to wrestle with the question, are they going to seat him? Are they going to investigate him? Are they going to expel him? And do they agree with him that Muslims shouldn't serve in Congress? Do they agree with him that things were better when we had slavery? Do they agree with him that homosexuality should be illegal? I mean, he would have been an albatross for them. And I talked to many Republicans during the race who said it would have been a better political outcome for them to just take the loss, have Doug Jones go to the Senate. They feel very confident that in 3 years they could get the seat back, but that Moore being in the Senate would actually have been a worse outcome. So maybe they dodged a bullet. As the president acknowledged at the White House today, Wednesday, he said, I know some Republicans are happy about this outcome.
Looking at what happened last month in Virginia and now Alabama, it's obviously, at least those two elections, it was a trend that could favor the Democrats. Do you see any of it spilling into 2018, or this could be just isolated?
Yes. Well, first of all, Alabama was a really unique case because you had a uniquely controversial fringe candidate in a state where Republicans shouldn't lose. But I do think Democrats have a playbook for 2018, and you could see it working in both of these states. And what it is that finally they figured out to get their base voters out, worked in Virginia, big turnout among minorities, young people, single women, college-educated suburbanites. That was also true in Alabama. In Virginia, however, Democrats didn't make any inroads into the Trump vote in non-metro areas, but that was enough because Virginia is a light blue state to begin with. In Alabama, Doug Jones took that basic playbook and tweaked it a little. He did get some crossover voters, but sure, why wouldn't this work for them in other states and congressional districts where they have to win? Absolutely. Look, Democrats have the edge with enthusiasm now. We've now have several examples, Virginia, Alabama. Conservatives are not as excited. Trump has fired up Democrats more than he's fired up his own voters. So, yes, I think that this will have repercussions all over the country. Will it be enough for Democrats to get over the mighty fortress of redistricting? I don't know. But a lot of Republicans will tell you they feel a big blue wave coming right at them.
And in the Senate, which is 51-49, now, I mean, obviously they need one fewer state to take a majority.
That's right. They would have to pick up two seats. They were hoping to get Nevada, and which is the only state where there's a Republican incumbent senator that, in a state that Hillary Clinton won. They also were hopeful about Arizona, where Jeff Flake is stepping down. They also have to hang on to their 10 Senate incumbents that are in states that Trump won. So I think the map is still daunting for them. But what's interesting to me is when I would talk to Republicans before Tuesday and say, well, what's your best case scenario for 2018 for the Senate? They said, oh, just limiting our losses. In other words, staying the same was beyond their wildest dreams. Now I think they feel more confident.
One final thought on Roy Moore. As of now, when we're recording this, he still hasn't conceded. He said it's not over.
And that's what we've got to do, is wait on God and let this process play out. I know it's late. We can't wait and have everybody wait till after 11 o'clock. But the votes are still coming in, and we're looking at that. May God bless you as you go on. May he give you a safe journey. And thank you for coming tonight. It's not over, and it's going to take some time. Thank you.
We haven't heard the last of it, but on the other hand, the Republican Party of Alabama said they don't want a recount. They wouldn't support him if he asks for one. If the final results are less than 0.5%, he could have a recount. Otherwise, the law is a little bit contested there, but it's possible if that's not the case, he would have to pay for a recount himself. And we'll just have to see what happens. But right now, the latest count is some 1.7%. That seems to be well outside the margin for a recount.
And do you think we've heard the last of Roy Moore?
Probably not. You know, he lost a lot of races, been removed from the state Supreme Court twice, and kept on running. So I don't think that we've heard the last of him.
Well, we couldn't get God, but we did get Mara Liasson, who is NPR's national political correspondent. Mara, thank you so much.
Thanks. It was great to talk to you.
Spoiler alert. If you didn't know that William McKinley, the nation's 25th president, was assassinated in the first year of his second term, apologies that you had to learn it this way. And if you think the assassination, which took place in September of 1901, is all there is to know about him, you are sadly mistaken. Robert Merry proves it in his great new book, President McKinley, Architect of the American Century. McKinley may never measure up historically the way his successor, Teddy Roosevelt, has, but he is an underrated figure who played a huge role in the growth of a world superpower in the early moments of the 20th century. The last time we had Bob Merry on The Political Junkie was to talk about his previous book on President James Polk. This time we move up a half a century later to focus on McKinley. Bob Merry, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's my pleasure as well. And, you know, I think, as I was saying to you right before we just started recording right now, that I think what struck me in reading your book is how much I didn't know about him and how significant a role he played in, I was going to say, in making America great again, but certainly in making America great, a very aggressive foreign policy, that's for sure.
Yes, indeed. He was. He didn't come crashing into office with great plans or visions. But he knew how to manage events, and he knew where he wanted to take America, and where he wanted to take America was where he did take America.
Well, even before he got to the White House, and before we could talk about the front porch campaign and the behind the scenes intrigue of Mark Hanna, tell me, who was William McKinley?
Well, William McKinley was a very ordinary Ohioan of his era. He was born 18 years before the Civil War. He was 18 when it occurred, so 1843. He enlists as an 18-year-old private. He ends the war as a 22-year-old major, most of his promotions coming as a result of battlefield heroics. He was quite courageous, didn't seem to know the use of fear. And so he gets out of the Civil War with a good, strong sense of who he is. His great mentor was Rutherford B. Hayes, his commanding officer, and a budding politician who was getting into Congress and getting into, became the governor and became president. And McKinley wanted to follow in his footsteps, and so he becomes a lawyer and goes into politics.
Well, I was going to say that it seems like from everything I read in your book, the exploits he had in the war and the great connections he made, he went into politics, he was elected to Congress, and then it sounds like he was elected, defeated. They had something back then called redistricting.
They did indeed. Well, he served 14 years, and he did, in fact, lose two elections. One of which, however, was disputed, and there was recounts and recounts, and he was declared the winner, but there was still a recount afterwards, and so he goes to Washington to continue to serve, and he finds out halfway through his I think it was his third term, that he wasn't the congressman after all, so he has to go back, but he regains that seat. Every time the Democrats took control of the state legislature, they redistricted him into a situation that was tough. And every time the Republicans regained it, they redistricted him in a situation that was much easier. But finally, when he lost in 1890, the redistricting played a part in that. And he was very clever in terms of he was an indefatigable politician. And if he got new territory that was more challenging, he often just went there and managed to turn people around. But 1890 had to do with the McKinley Tariff. He was chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. He shepherded a major tariff bill through Congress. The economy wasn't doing so well. And people blamed the tariff, and they blamed him, and his constituents blamed him, and Republicans all over the country got blamed, and it was a terrible year for Republicans. And he lost his job over it, and that's when he decided to run for governor.
Well, what got him the presidential nomination in 1896? I mean, I checked my charts, and he didn't win the Iowa caucuses or the New Hampshire primary.
I know. The only reason he didn't is because he didn't have them.
Exactly. Well, that's one reason. I mean, I know that he was, governor of Ohio is not a small thing, but it seems like it was almost an effortless. No, effortless is a little strong of a word, but it didn't seem like it was one of those conventions, Republican conventions, where on the 75th ballot they turned to William McKinley. It sounds like he almost was the favorite going in.
I think what we could say is that for McKinley, 1896 was a favorable year. He had emerged out of that 1890 debacle as a successful governor of a very big state and a growing, vibrant state that people looked to. And I don't think there were a lot of very natural, big-time competitors.
Everything I've read about McKinley always talk about the role that Hanna played in getting him the nomination, getting him elected president, serving him as president, setting the path for the second term. Your book seems to give, I could be reading it wrong, but it seems like you're not as high on Hanna, or should I say that you're higher on McKinley and McKinley's abilities than the simplistic way of looking at it, saying that, well, Hanna is the one responsible for everything.
Yeah, that's quite a canard. You know, I have to say that Hanna was the puppeteer and McKinley was the puppet. We've seen the cartoons. I mean, I think most of your listeners will remember some of the cartoons where this big Hanna character with the dollar signs all over his expensive suit would have little McKinley in his lap or as a puppet, and he's manipulating him. That was a canard then. And, you know, it was pretty much exploded contemporaneously.
I remember our conversation about President Polk, a few months back, and you were talking about how he expanded U.S. territory with, right, the acquisition of Oregon, and he went to war with Mexico over California. But McKinley also turned out to be a kind of president who would fight a war if it meant expanding U.S. territory.
Ken, that's a question that has really bedeviled, I think, a lot of historians. There's a view among some historians, and I think it's primarily the Teddy Roosevelt biographers, that McKinley didn't want to go to war with Spain, and he just basically got pulled kicking and screaming into a war that he didn't really want. If you study McKinley carefully and you read the papers and you read the communications and the diplomatic cables and all that, you see that that wasn't the case. Yes, it was true that McKinley wanted to avoid a war with Spain, but he set out very, very early to kick Spain out of the Caribbean. He just wanted to do it without a war. So when he started his diplomatic approach, nobody. And the Congress was agitating for war, and the American people were getting more and more angry about what was happening in Cuba, where the insurrection against Spanish rule was leading to extremely terrible, bloody episodes. So it looked like all this pressure was mounting on him and that it just basically overwhelmed him. But in fact, what he did was engage in a diplomatic initiative with Spain, with Madrid, in which he basically said, look, you guys got to end this war. And I don't care how you do it. You can end it by winning it, or you can end it by negotiating an end to it, or you can bug out, whatever you do. But you've got to stop this war because it's destabilizing the Caribbean, and the Caribbean is in our sphere of influence, and we can't allow that kind of destabilization. And American citizens were threatened, and the question of whether some other great power was going to come in and take over Cuba because of the chaos was a very serious question at the time. So Spain initially, knowing that America was a powerful country, an emerging country, but an increasingly powerful country, was trying to accommodate this. But finally, they just weren't going to put up with this pressure any longer. And they essentially said, look, this isn't any of your business. I don't care how close it is to your shores. This is Spanish territory. And McKinley just refused to back down. And I think there was going to be a war. And I think McKinley knew there was going to be a war. But he was still hoping that he could get them to find a way out. And it was increasingly going to be, the only out was going to be Spain just leaving Cuba. And I don't know whether Spain would have done that. I doubt it. So I think there probably would have been a war. But then, of course, the battleship Maine blew up in Havana Harbor, and that made war inevitable.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like the war was happening anyway. There's something, we're almost running out of time, but there's something I want to tell you, talk to you about, because one of the most fascinating things to me about McKinley was the decision to name Teddy Roosevelt as his running mate. You know, obviously his first vice president, Hobart, died in office. But what I liked about the way you write about the picking of Roosevelt, it seems like, New York Republicans, you mentioned the boss earlier, but they wanted Roosevelt out of New York, get him out of our hair, and throw him in as vice president so he won't do any damage. And little do we know that basically moving him into the vice presidency is what created the myth of Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, it really did. I mean, McKinley didn't want to name Teddy Roosevelt as assistant naval secretary in his first term, but he had so many friends and supporters, and there was a lot of pressure to do it, so he finally did it. And he liked Teddy. I mean, he liked to go on these buggy rides in the afternoon, and he liked to have interesting people with him. McKinley did. And one of the interesting people that he particularly liked having with him on those buggy rides was Teddy Roosevelt, because he was so amusing and clever and voluble and interesting. But so then he does this amazing thing when the war breaks out. He creates the Rough Riders and he becomes a hero besides George Dewey, the admiral who destroyed the Philippine fleet, the Spanish fleet in the Pacific. He was the greatest hero from the war. And so he becomes governor immediately. And the power of the pro-Roosevelt faction at the Republican convention, McKinley wasn't there, but he's following it pretty closely, was so powerful that it was irresistible. And McKinley knew that. He couldn't put himself four square against the convention, whatever he thought of Roosevelt, and he liked him enough. But Hanna hated him because he thought he was out of control and he wasn't somebody that would be loyal, and he was right about that. But nevertheless, Hanna tried to thwart this. And McKinley had to kind of wrap Hanna's knuckles a little bit, because he was putting McKinley in a position, untenable position of opposing the convention on the only thing that mattered to the convention, which was putting Teddy Roosevelt on a ticket. So he had to basically tell Hanna to back off, and Hanna finally did. But he sends a note afterwards and saying, well, all came out okay, Governor, and I'm very pleased, or Mr. President at that point, I'm very pleased. We had our little controversy, but it's over now. Your job is to stay alive for the next 4 years.
Yeah. And he did not, of course, obviously. About 9 months or six months into his second term.
Yeah, just about 6 months.
A few years ago, you wrote this book I really, really like about where you rated all the presidents. I think it was called Where They Stand. So given all the thing, I mean, of course, he was assassinated, which ended his presidency, and all the pluses and minuses, where do you put McKinley on the list of presidents?
Well, I haven't really sat down and tried to see who I put him above, who ranks higher than him in some of these surveys that have been conducted over the years. You know, in Steve Neal's survey in 1981, I think it was, he comes up to 11th. Which is pretty high. Normally, he's ranked in like 16, 15. I think I would probably put him at 12, between 10 and 12. But, you know, I've got my own views about some presidents, and some of them I think are overrated, and some of them are underrated, and I think McKinley's one that right now is somewhat underrated.
I mean, clearly he's no James Polk.
Well, yeah, he was no James Polk. James Polk gets rated up there in the number 10, 9 sometimes, almost in the near great category. And so I think McKinley probably deserves to be up there pretty close. They both were war presidents. They both were successful war presidents, and they both enhanced America's position in the world or on the continent as a result of their presidency. So that's not small stuff.
Robert Murray is the author of President McKinley, Architect of the American Century. Bob, it's a great book, and it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Thank you so much, Ken, always.
Conquistador, your stallion stands in need of company, and like some angel's haloed brow, you reek of purity. I see your armor plated breast has long since lost a sheen, and in your deathmatch bed there are no signs which can be seen. Though I hope for something to find, I can see no.
Anyone who listens to this program knows we have a fondness and an appreciation for political history and glass breaking. 8 years ago in Houston, political history was made in this glass breaking moment.
I, Anise Parker,
do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute
the duties of the office
of mayor of the city of Houston
of the state of Texas
so help me God.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Anise Parker, a Democrat, was elected mayor in the nation's fourth largest city in 2009. She was not the first female mayor of Houston. That honor went to Kathy Whitmire in 1981. But she was the first openly gay woman elected mayor of a major city in history, going on to win 3 two-year terms. She was term limited after 2015. The history wasn't lost on her in her victory speech.
This election has changed the world for the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered community. Just as it is about transforming the lives of all Houstonians for the better. And that's what my administration will be about.
Last week, Anise Parker became the new president and CEO of the Victory Fund and Victory Institute, two organizations that fight to increase LGBT representation in politics. With gay rights under attack by the administration and under assault in the courts, we thought it would be a good time to check in with her. Anise Parker, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
I am glad to visit with you.
Well, thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. And of course, you and I are speaking one day after the results of the Alabama Senate election, which was a surprise defeat for the Republican candidate, Roy Moore, who has said in the past that homosexuality should be illegal, that homosexuality was, quote, the same thing as having sex with a cow, and who was removed as the chief judge of the Alabama Supreme Court because he refused to implement laws protecting same-sex couples. So I ask you this, Anise, with a straight face. What's your reaction to the results in Alabama?
Well, it's not so good on radio, but I'm here doing the happy dance. Roy Moore was not just a bigot toward the LGBTQ community. He had not just last century, but 19th century attitudes toward women, toward minorities. He has made offensive statements any number of times to multiple communities, and he would have been an absolute staunch opponent to many of the progressive initiatives that those of us in the LGBT community want to champion. And apparently he's personally not a nice guy and potentially a pedophile.
Everything I've seen on social media in the past couple of days from the LGBTQ community talk about, you know, what a great victory it was for Doug Jones to win in Alabama. But it's also fair to say that it doesn't mean that gay rights are no longer at risk.
Gay rights didn't necessarily win Alabama. Minority voters won Alabama. And we need to be very, very clear about that. And it's a good reminder for all LGBTQ candidates that we don't win on our own. We win in coalitions. And it was particularly black women who won for the Democrats in Alabama. And often black women are important to our candidates. So I wouldn't have been mayor of Houston without minority voters. 75% of the African-American vote, 60% of the Latino vote in my race. And hopefully every bit of the gay vote, GLBTQ vote, when I first ran. But our races are about building coalitions and creating understanding in our constituents, our potential constituents, of the shared needs of our communities.
When you first ran for mayor of Houston in 2009, was your sexual identity a campaign issue?
No, not really, because by the time I ran for mayor in 2009, I'd already been elected 6 times citywide in Houston. Houstonians were aware of it. There was one attack piece put out by supporters of the guy I was in the runoff with. The three main candidates for mayor when I was running that year were all Democrats. And I ended up in a runoff with an African-American Democrat, and some of his supporters put out a hit piece, but it really was a non-issue in the campaign. It had no measurable impact because the voters knew me. In fact, I think I'm mayor for two reasons. One, I was coming out of the controller's office just as we were sliding into a major recession. And the only other city controller to have become mayor and the only other woman was Kathy Whitmire, and she got to preside over a major recession in the city of Houston. You want the person who understands the finances. And then in a time of uncertainty, I was the only one who'd been elected before. So the voters knew me. They knew what I was about. And the other guy, who under other circumstances I might have voted for, nice guy, but he was a complete unknown to voters and a first-time candidate.
As mayor, though, you tried to push through an equal rights ordinance. It was known as HERO. Explain what that was and tell me what you were trying to do.
You know, the most important thing I can say is what it wasn't. Most of the major cities across America have had non-discrimination ordinances for a very long time. And what they've done over the last 10, 15 years is amend those ordinances to add sexual orientation and gender identity. Houston, as in so many things, we were the only major city that had no non-discrimination ordinance. All we had are the federal protections. There was no local statute. And so HERO was actually a standalone comprehensive ordinance that would have applied to women and minorities, racial and ethnic minorities, to religious protections, protections for vets, et cetera, and sexual orientation and gender identity. But if you were looking at it from the outside, it was all about transgender women and so-called men and women's bathrooms. We allowed the other side, the sort of bitter homophobic right, to own the narrative, and they jumped on that. And I've been an activist for a very long time. I started in the 70s, and I've seen the progress we've made, and I've lived the progress we've made. But it was a stark reminder to me of the way we have attained our progress, and that is, we don't win on the intellectual argument. I mean, we had great commercials across the city about showing African American. We actually had a really bad incident of discrimination where a bunch of young black guys were denied entrance to a hot nightclub because they were black. And we did TV commercials around them to say, you know, this is an ordinance about everybody. But the other side just kept pounding away on this fear that this would make, and all lies, that this would make all bastards in Houston gender neutral, and on and on and on.
And it went before the voters and it got clobbered.
Yeah. And you can't win an emotional argument with an intellectual appeal. And that's what we kept trying to do. And we were getting money and politicians from all over the country on the right. And they were learning the playbook that they then tried to roll out in North Carolina, and they've tried to roll out here in Texas, and it's all to demonize transgender women and, you know, the men in women's bathrooms and sexual predators. And oddly, and some of the, even one of the, they ran a campaign ad in Houston, and I've seen that exact clone ad that came out in the 70s somewhere over in, I think, North Carolina. I mean, there's the same arguments, but back then it was about gays and lesbians, and primarily gays, gay men. And now they're using it against transgender women. And that lesson that we need to go back to is that in the 45 years or so of the modern gay rights movement, it's not been about activists. It's been about individuals coming out in all aspects of their lives so that people know us and aren't scared of us. And too many Americans don't know someone who is transgender. And as long as you can take someone who's an other and make them fearful or make them an object of fear, you can get people to vote against their rights.
I was just thinking, not only was the campaign against gays and lesbians, but there was also a personal attacks on you. And the reason I'm thinking that, I have a little clip here I'm going to play from Pat Robertson on what he thought you were preparing to do.
This lady ran as a moderate or whatever, and she was a lesbian, but she's kind of stayed under wraps, so to speak, and now suddenly her predilections are coming forward, and this is one of the most outrageous demands that I have ever heard in any city in the United States in our history. This is unbelievable, and this is Houston, Texas, place where the Baptists are so strong. What are the Baptists doing down there now, letting this thing go forward? This woman is just has exceeded any authority of any city official that I have ever heard about in the entire history of the United States of America. Now, that's a lot.
Anise, what are you doing to Houston?
Raising its profile, growing its economy. Fast Company made us a city on the move while I was mayor. We popped up on every best of list. Apparently, I was doing a lot of really great things, except for this one thing that they didn't like.
Is there a different political climate today when it comes to LGBTQ rights, you think?
As opposed to when?
Well, when you were first elected or when Pat Robertson would have his heyday and things like the moral majority would have their say?
I attended my first LGBT organizing event in 1975. I have been doing this for a very long time, and so... what happens now, I have to take a little bit of a grain of salt because the world is so much better for us than it was then. But over the last few years, we have taken a huge step backward in a lot of ways, and not just the LGBTQ community, but women and minorities, attacks on immigrants. There are many, many of us who are seeing hard-fought gains under attack by the right. And, I don't think we should feel particularly singled out, but I think we should be absolutely concerned, and it should make us redouble our efforts.
What does your organization have planned for the 2018 elections?
Oh, that's pretty simple and straightforward. Elect more LGBTQ candidates. And in order to do that, we need to work with coalitions in those communities where our candidates are running. We need to build strong coalitions. We need to work with other organizations who can potentially support those candidates, whether those are women's organizations or labor organizations or environmental organizations, and to do the strong, coordinated campaigns that can be successful. There is definitely a wave out there, a response to the attacks on so many of the values that we hold dear, and we need to take advantage of that. The other thing that every progressive organization is trying to do is to harness the attention and energy of younger voters. One of the saddest things to me, it wasn't losing the vote on HERO. A city that elected me 9 times, I'm really frustrated that it voted in fear of transgender women. But the really frustrating thing was that the average age of a voter in that city election was 68 years old. And that was the key. Younger voters get it. Younger voters have passion. They understand these issues. But it hasn't yet translated into kind of voting strengths that we need to see. And so finding, training, recruiting, putting good candidates in the field, supporting those candidates, building coalitions, and trying to do it in a way that engages the younger voters out there who are going to be the candidates of the future and who are going to be running this world that we're going to leave them, they need to start taking a stake in it.
Do the results in Virginia and now Alabama, do they encourage you and encourage your efforts, you think?
Yes and no. To see a candidate with so many horrific negatives as Roy Moore be able to be on the verge of going to the Senate is horrifying. To see the way the coalition came together around Doug Jones is very gratifying. But it never should have taken that kind of overwhelming work to knock off someone so terrible.
Anise Parker is the former three-term mayor of Houston, who's the new president and CEO of the Victory Fund and Victory Institute, two organizations that fight to increase LGBTQ representation in politics. Mayor Parker, thank you so much for being on the program.
Glad to visit with you. Thank you.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the first female African-American mayor elected in one of the nation's top 25 cities? The answer, Sharon Pratt Dixon. A former treasurer of the Democratic National Committee, Dixon was elected in Washington, D.C. in 1990, succeeding Marion Barry. And the randomly selected winner is Ellen Burkett Morris of Louisville, Kentucky. Ellen wins the coveted Political Junkie button. And we have a Scuttlebutt winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. The last contest led off with a Charlie Rose for Congress button. Not that Charlie Rose, the one from North Carolina. Then came a button mocking Dan Quayle with the words, colored any good books lately? And a Goldwater button that simply says Barry, followed by a pair of glasses, from Goldwater's 1968 Senate race in Arizona. So when you combine rose and colored and glasses, you kind of get rose-colored glasses, the tendency to see things in a positive light, which many people in this country had until fairly recently. And the winner is Lori Bonini of Laramie, Wyoming. We'll have a new Scuttlebutt puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's time for This Week in Political History. He was the best known and the most powerful member of Congress. So said the Almanac of American Politics in 1974 of Wilbur Mills, the Arkansas Democrat who chaired the House Ways and Means Committee. Whatever he wanted, whatever he worked for, he got. On taxes, on trade, on health care, on welfare policy. In his 36 years in office, he had only one notable failure. A misguided bid for the 1972 Democratic presidential nomination that went nowhere. But other than that, a Midas touch. That is, until October 9, 1974. Driving in a car in Washington, D.C. with the lights out, Mills was stopped by the police at 2 a.m. A passenger in his car, a stripper known as Fanny Fox, tried to escape by jumping out of the car and into the Tidal Basin, where she was rescued by police. Fortunately for Mills, the incident came with less than a month to go before the election, in which he had a Republican challenger for the first time in his career. The candidate, Judy Petty, broke 40%, but Mills still won by 17 percentage points. If that was the end of it, it would have been no more than a blot on his career. But it wasn't. What happened next is the reason why Mills announced, 43 years ago this week, he would be stepping down as chairman of Ways and Means. And what did happen next? For that, we go to David Rosen, author of the book Sex Scandal America, Politics and the Ritual of Public Shaming. David, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Well, thank you very much. And as a political junkie myself, I'm very pleased that you invited me to participate. And I just want to add one little note about Miss Fox. She was actually known as the Argentinian firecracker. And she was a married lady, you should understand, at the time.
So was Wilbur Mills.
So his fascination with her had been quite well known within the Washington, D.C. circuit, where she was a very popular stripper. And so he had been a regular visitor to the strip club that she performed in, and then went on to see her a couple months later in a strip club up in Boston.
But the thing that really brought him down, I think, was the end of the time in Boston at the end of November, in which a drunken Wilbur Mills got on stage. Let me play a little piece of tape. This is how Jack Kelly, who's a reporter with Boston's WNAC-TV, here's how he described the incident.
The joke goes that Fannie Fox has her ways and means, and this past weekend she apparently did. Wilbur Mills arrived in town Friday night and checked into a four-room suite at Boston's 57 Hotel complex, registering under the name of an aide. Saturday night, he went to the Pilgrim Theater to see Fannie's burlesque show, and at its conclusion, the Argentine firecracker asked Mills up on the stage. To the surprise of the audience, he honored that request.
I mean, David, what's so remarkable to me is that this is the most powerful guy in Congress, and here he is carrying on with a stripper, you know, and it's just, you know, wow.
Exactly. No, and he thought he could get away with it. I mean, and that it wouldn't amount to anything. I mean, it's chutzpah, as some people would call it.
Well, another thing about that event is that the reporters were waiting by the exit as Mills and Fox tried to leave the theater. He was forced to speak to reporters. Let's listen to that.
How do you feel the American public will react to your attention to Miss Fox?
Well, they should react very well, very favorably. All I'm trying to do is to launch a career.
Don't you think this looks bad for you personally as a married chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, though?
My wife's in on it.
his wife's in on it. I mean, did he sound drunk? I don't want to...
Oh, totally. I mean, the guy was plastered. I mean, let's get down to it. I mean, look, he was completely plastered.
I think of stories in the old days, like when Strom Thurmond would grope a woman in the Senate elevator and people would roll their eyes and say, oh, that's Strom being Strom. Whereas now, though, the women are coming forward and it's not cute story. Not that it should ever have been cute stories, but they don't seem cute anymore. They seem exactly what they're called, harassment, and people are speaking out on that.
Right.
David Rosen is the author of the book Sex Scandal America, Politics and the Ritual of Public Shaming. And you can find more on his website at sex-politics.com. David, thanks so much for being on the program.
Oh, thanks. It was great. I appreciate it and enjoy the cold weather and the holidays coming up.
Thank you so much. It was 43 years ago this week, on December 11th, 1974, when Wilbur Mills, an Arkansas Democrat who was the most powerful member of Congress, chairing the most powerful committee in Congress, gave up his chairmanship of the House Ways and Means Committee because of his role in an ongoing sex scandal. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. All you ever think about is sex. All you ever think about, excuse me. All you ever think about is sex. All right with me. All you ever think about is sex. All you ever think about, excuse me. All you ever think about is sex. All right with me. That's it for this week's show. And as the year winds down, be sure to join us next week for our annual Remembrances special, when we'll pay tribute to many of the giants of politics and the media who passed away this year. In the meantime, be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week. All you ever think about-